Scientists are about to give the Kilogram what is apparently a much-needed facelift. But scientists have decided that it needs to be swapped for something a little more modern, because despite the metal being kept in carefully controlled environments, its weight does change over time. Too much for it still to be considered totally accurate. A heavyweight meeting at the Palace of Versailles in Paris this week will finally see the Kilogram replaced with something that has a constant weight.
It's not a bank, and it doesn't do software. What SoftBank does do nowadays is invest in tech firms. Now it wants investors to return the love. The Japanese firm planning to sell shares in its domestic mobile phone business for about $21 billion. That would mark one of the biggest IPOs ever.
This is the Zhuhai Air Show, one of the biggest displays of China's aviation ambitions. But this year, attendance numbers have fallen. Media reports say organizers have scaled back the show. Some think it's down to the trade war between Beijing and Washington. Instead, China used the event to showcase closer ties with Moscow.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Tuesday. It's November 13th. 5:10 in the morning. Thank you for being with us for another edition of The Opening Bell and another business day getting underway. We've put together a really good broadcast for you today. And our first segment this morning, could Chicago learn something about gang violence from Sacramento's approach? We'll talk to the Washington Post's national correspondent covering law enforcement and justice about how that might be done and what's happening in Sacramento that Chicago might be able to learn from a little bit later in the program this morning. Conversation will focus on performance transportation transformation at A.T. Kearney. We'll talk a little bit about how people are preparing people, companies, and countries to come out on top in the new economy, what that will mean at 5:40 this morning, the future of production and the business of production a little bit later on. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward opening gains on Wall Street. After a rough day yesterday on Wall Street, investors will be keeping a close eye on the market today after the Dow Jones dropped more than 600 points yesterday as Apple led a tech industry rout. The company's shares dropped after a company that makes technology for the iPhone's face recognition function, Lumentum Holdings, cut its outlook for the fiscal quarter, second quarter of 2019. That, coupled with lingering worries about global trade, weighed down investor confidence at the closing bell. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 602 points. The NASDAQ lost 206 points. The S&P dropped nearly 55 points. This morning, futures are up about 0.5% on the Dow, NASDAQ, and the S&P. Around the globe this morning, markets in Europe are generally higher. The FTSE is up just a fraction in London. The DAX in Germany is up about 0.5%. And the CAC in France is up just a fraction in early going this morning, mid-going during the day there. In Asia, markets are generally lower with the Nikkei off nearly 2%. And oil is trading at $58.59 a barrel, which is down about $1.34. Couple of stories that we're watching for you this morning. Amazon now reportedly choosing, as has been reported, New York City and Northern Virginia as its second headquarters. Wall Street Journal says an announcement coming today. The online retail giant says its second headquarters will create about 50,000 new jobs. New York Governor Cuomo said he was working with Amazon in hopes of securing a headquarters site in Long Island City. The second site would reportedly be the Crystal City section of Arlington, Virginia. Chicago was one of the contenders for the second headquarters. Lyft is ready to roll out a frequent riders reward program for people who use the ride-hailing app the most. Starting in December, the more people travel, the more points they'll get for perks, including ride upgrades and more experienced drivers. The reward program also will include double points days to encourage people to use Lyft. The company says more people will have access next year, and it's promising to listen to what riders say and to make tweaks in the program. We begin front and center this morning with crime, crime management, crime control. Wesley Lowery is the national correspondent at the Washington Post covering law enforcement and justice. Wesley, good morning and welcome to the Opening Bell.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm looking forward to our conversation because crime is a subject that is front and center here in Chicago almost every day. You've been writing about how Sacramento has been handling things. Tell us about this.
Certainly. And so, yeah, I was recently out in Sacramento doing a piece on a program that they've started out there called Advance Peace. Now, the way this program works is, first of all, it's based on kind of a belief that law enforcement has in most major cities, Chicago included, which is that most violent crime is committed by a very small handful of people, and that the people who commit violent crime are also very likely to be the victims of violent crime. That you could, many police departments have a literal list of the men who they think are most likely to be killed or kill someone in the forthcoming year. And so what Sacramento has done, following the lead of Richmond, California, is they've started a program where they're very directly targeting with social services and mentorship the men on that list, right? In many cases, those are men who already are believed to have committed some type of crime, even though the police can't quite prove it, to charge that person. But what they do with this program is they identify these men, they assign them mentors, and then they basically overwhelm them, harass them, wrap them in these services. They make them create life maps and so goals, whether it's, all right, I need to get my GED or a job. They try to identify what things might be contributing to the likelihood of committing violence, whether it's mental health or drug addiction, broken home, unstable housing. And then after 6 months, if the men are making satisfactory progress towards the stated goals, they become eligible for cash stipends once a week, up to $1,000 a month, although typically, usually, it's just a few hundred dollars here and there. And that's the controversial part of the program, right? Because the program can be framed one of two ways. You can frame it as, look, this is a program targeting the people most likely to commit violence to try to prevent them from doing it and trying to stabilize them financially and otherwise, or it can be framed as, wait, they're paying cash to violent criminals to get them to stop shooting each other. And that's, there's been a lot of framing like that in conversations about this program.
What has been the reaction there on the ground in Sacramento among the community to this?
Of course, initially there was a lot of skepticism. So again, this was a program that was founded or kind of pioneered in Richmond, California, so not too far from Sacramento, and saw some success there. But when the city at the time was seeing an uptick, about 2016, seeing a real uptick in violence and uptick in gang crime, or what was believed to be gang-related crime, and the city officials really wanted to try something outside of the box, try something new. But there were a lot of questions, right? You know, this is the type of program on its face. Tends to rile people up a little bit. Wait, we're going to pay taxpayer dollars for this kind of deep social investment in guys who we think maybe already committed crimes? But one of the arguments in favor of it or the way that the leadership explains this is that in most cities, it's estimated that a homicide costs taxpayers about $1 million in investigatory cost, in incarceration, in crime scene, and that in a program like this, you end up ultimately investing probably tens of thousands of dollars in each of these young men who are very likely to be a homicide victim or to commit one. And so what happens is if you have a program that enrolls 50 people, all it has to do is prevent a handful of homicides to very quickly pay for itself. And meanwhile, hopefully prevent communities from having to deal with the trauma of those homicides happening.
The question I think that probably is jumping off to everybody this morning listening to this is if some of these men, some of these people are committing the crimes and the police are having a hard time solving it, wouldn't it be better to put those resources into police, more police resources to perhaps find the evidence to put the people in jail?
So that's one question that's come up time and time again, both in Richmond, where it started, as well as in Sacramento, right? This push and pull between where should these resources be invested? And I think there are probably some real strong arguments to be made in favor of that. One of the responses to that is that, well, and the police would often be the ones to tell you this, in some of these cases, the only witnesses to these crimes, the only people who can potentially help you turn one of them are the shooters themselves, right? That some of these crimes are functionally unsolvable because there isn't the evidence needed. And that in the meantime, if you cannot arrest someone, these are still young men who are out there in the streets. And and that someone's committed one violent crime like this, it's very likely to prompt a retaliatory cycle. And so in the meantime, whether you're investigating it or not, whether there's more resources there or not, the community is still dealing with this person being out there. And so the argument that the leaders of Advanced Peace would make is that no matter what you're doing, whether you're giving more money to police, that this is something you still might do. One thing that is interesting here is that unlike some other programs, Operation Ceasefire, for example, which I know has been done in Chicago and similar programs, this program is not led by the police themselves, right? This is not the police giving mentorship. That in some ways there is a separation here. It's certainly there's city money involved and there's cooperation with the police, but it's not a investigatory arm, right? These conversations with these young men aren't trying to lead to potential tips. That functionally, this is not about solving crime. It's about preventing it before it happens.
A conversation about how Sacramento is trying to stop violence before it happens with a program that's called Advance Peace. Wesley, I'm kind of curious, and these folks who are going to intervene with some of these gang members, with some of these others who are at risk, this seems like a dangerous proposition.
Certainly. And what's interesting is the way this program is structured is that much of the leadership, the program manager and the mentors themselves, are almost all formerly incarcerated men themselves. Many of them formerly gang-affiliated, former drug dealers or gun runners, guys who themselves have a lot of credibility in the neighborhoods and with many of the young men who they're trying to interact with. Similar programs in the past have leaned very heavily on law enforcement and on the faith community, on pastors and clergy. But the structure of this program tries to get at the idea that in many of these communities, in many of these neighborhoods, places that traditionally kind of commanded that type of respect, that were typically pillars of community, and in some communities aren't there anymore, that there are many neighborhoods and many communities where your local pastor, your local clergy really isn't the type of person who can really reach some of the people who are the furthest into these cycles of violence. But someone who themselves used to be on those same street corners might have a different effect or a different chance at this. And so I spent a lot of time when I was in Sacramento with these mentors, and they call them community change agents, and they're really just a bunch of guys, many of whom, have been out of prison for a few years, who themselves saw some type of turnaround while they were incarcerated, who are now doing basically high-end mentor work for day in and day out, waking up in the morning, calling all of their guys, seeing where they are, seeing what they're up to. If they hear there's been a shooting somewhere, they show up at the scene themselves to make sure none of their guys were involved, and seeing where the retaliation might happen. It really is fascinating to watch in person.
What would be the challenges of scaling this up? Sacramento's not Chicago, not New York City. So what would be the challenge here going forward?
Of course. I mean, I think one of the challenges is that, in terms of raw scale, right, in a city like Sacramento, you are talking about maybe 50 guys, right, who are driving the majority of the violence. In a city like Chicago, you're probably pushing that up into the number into the hundreds, just in terms of the number of shootings that are happening in a given week, in a given month, much less in a year. Also, because of that, you have to deal with the speed with which those things are happening. Very often in a city like Chicago, you might see two or three shootings in a given night that are all somehow linked to each other. And the idea that you might be able to get to the people who would be involved in the second before it happens could present some real logistical challenges, right? But there is something to be said, whether it's this program or some alteration of it or other programs, and it's not that no one in Chicago is doing work like this, there are people who are attempting to do it. The question remains, right, if most major cities believe they know who the people are who are likely to kill or be killed, it raises this question of what is the obligation to do something to try to stop it, and not just from the law enforcement perspective, and there certainly is a question about what's the law enforcement obligation there, but also if you know that someone's likely to become a victim of a crime, what is our collective obligation, the government or the taxpayers, to try to get to that person and either get them out, to wrap them in services, or to prevent this from happening? And I think that programs like this are at least attempting to address that question.
Wesley, good conversation. Thank you for being with us this morning. We're going to link out to your story so everybody can read the details of it. Very exciting. We'll stay tuned to see how this progresses.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me. Happy to join anytime.
Wesley Lowery, a national correspondent at the Washington Post, covering law enforcement and justice. You can read his work at WashingtonPost.com, and we'll link out to the story as well in the podcast of The Opening Bell a little later this morning at WGNRadio.com.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Tuesday edition of The Opening Bell. Things are about to change as the future of production of goods and services poised to have some transformation that will be good and perhaps even bad. It's so significant that the World Economic Forum has teamed up with A.T. Kearney to look at some of the scenarios for future production and how companies can prepare for what is next. Joining us now is Azaz Farooqi. He's the Senior Manager of Operations and Performance Transportation at A.T. Kearney. Azaz, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Good morning.
Let's talk a little bit about, first, what we're give us the big kind of big picture of what it is that we're waiting for. I know a lot of people are calling this the fourth industrial revolution that's coming, but what will be the effects of this for production for companies?
I think it's always difficult, right, in a situation like this where a lot of disruptive technologies are sort of taking shape, to know exactly when it'll change. But I think we can see the changes happening over the last few years. I mean, you look at some of the technologies that are out there, AI or artificial intelligence. It's been around for a long time, but we didn't have the computing power necessary or available to kind of do the algorithms or run the programs and so on. You look at 3D printing, that's been around since the 70s and so on. And again, similar issues. We couldn't get the qualities, the speed, and the strength and so on. So it never really took on. And so you look at all of these technologies individually, and it's almost we're at a point now where they've all matured from a technology standpoint in some form or fashion. And the other thing that's happening with that is that they're sort of converging 3D printing with AI, with analytics, with Internet of Things and so on. And so all of these things together are creating all kinds of opportunities. And as you look at manufacturing, there's not a single step in manufacturing that isn't getting touched by these technologies. So I think we're at a pretty exciting time, and it's going to be difficult. But my sense is that we're going to go through a lot of change in terms of how it impacts the individual, the businesses, the companies, as well as countries, right? I mean, you think about the countries that are developed, the countries that are developing, and the impact that it can have on maybe some economies which can potentially leapfrog some of the developed economies. So there's a whole lot of changes going through, and what I feel is going to happen is people who are agile, who are able to take advantage of tinkering or experimenting with these technologies at a smaller scale and kind of continue to perfect it as they go along, will be able to benefit from it.
Yeah, and you talk about the excitement level here. I agree with that. I think most people do. But the potential for destabilization is significant. If this isn't addressed, if people do not embrace some of this, start looking forward to it, what are some of the worst-case effects that we could see?
I think you look at all kinds of examples, right? I mean, BlackBerry became a poster child in some ways. It kind of lagged behind, and that's a potential for a lot of different companies that are stuck in sort of the traditional processes, aren't able to look at this transformative technologies to take advantage and reduce their cost, improve their quality, increase their speed to the market, and so on. If you just sit there and not take advantage of what's out there, I think you have a certain level of risk that you're looking at, and you could essentially become part of history.
Let's talk about what are some of the steps that companies are taking, countries are taking now, others are taking now, to get going on this. What would be some examples?
So I think from a company perspective, right, we at A.T. Kearney, I mean, when we work with companies in looking at their digital transformation, what we're seeing and what we're finding is that, I mean, you look at larger companies who have been around for 100-plus years and so on, innovation always has been a challenge. And when you think about these sort of disruptive technologies, it becomes even a bigger challenge because it's not necessarily something that's part of your DNA. And so what tends to work well is having a sense of the strategy for what you want to do on the digital end, so the Industry 4.0 technologies that are all out there, it's not necessarily all applicable to you. So figuring out what are the ones that you need to pursue and then creating a strategy around it that allows you to focus on the right elements of it. And then starting small. I mean, think of this as a lab, as an experiment in some ways, working with some of the incubation labs, working or having a joint venture with some of the folks that have already kind of gone through this, who can guide you along the way. And giving that team that is in charge of looking at this landscape the autonomy and creating that entrepreneurial mindset so they can have the liberty and as well as the means and the resources to start taking some of those meaningful steps and work on it. And the thing to keep in mind also is that this isn't a race to perfection because the technology landscape is constantly changing. And so you're not necessarily going to get to a point where there is maturity in what you're looking at. So it's iterating it and tinkering along with it till you get to a point where you feel it's good enough that you can move on to the next thing and continue the cycle all over again.
Yeah, it feels like that that should be happening now. I know that the deadline, at least in the some of the writings that A.T. Kearney and the World Economic Forum have done, they look at the state of production in 2030. 2030 is not that far away. It seems like some of this stuff is should have been started yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you brought that up. It's very true, but I think it's technology, when you look at the landscape, right, it's difficult to judge. There's a lot of businesses, a lot of countries even in some cases, that are waiting on others to sort of go ahead in some ways and do the tinkering, the experimentation, and see how they fare. If they fail, we'll learn from their failures, and then we'll perfect it before we jump on it. So there's this sense of the waiting game is happening right now, I think, in a lot of the cases where people are just a little bit they're shying away from putting their money, their resources into these things. And from a country perspective, I mean, you look at the example of AI, and there's a lot of press going on around how China is sort of spending all kinds of money on research and development, whereas in this side of the world, we're not really getting there as much. So I think it's important that we wake up as a country, as businesses, to the changing reality, because if we don't change our behaviors and we don't start thinking about these things and acting upon it, we're going to be left behind.
How concerned are you about the geopolitical part of this story? Brexit, I'm thinking of Brexit, I'm thinking of the Trump administration, the move away from the globalization, move. Do these and those are two big countries, how does this work into all of that?
So I think I focus on the digital transformation side and the future of production and so on. So I think when I look at it from the technology lens, we had published a paper on the impact of 3D printing on the U.S. economy and the jobs it can bring back. So I think if you look at it from that perspective, these technologies, so there's an element of spending resources on just the innovation piece, right, perfecting these technologies and taking them further. But then the other piece of it is, as we help businesses embrace these technologies, there is a great potential in a lot of ways to bring jobs back, so you could have things made in America here from 3D printing that we're potentially getting done outside. So from a geopolitical standpoint, you could be looking at an increased number of jobs if we can focus on some of those things. Now, if all the countries in the world are going to look at it from that perspective, I think that poses a bit of a challenge. But at the end of the day, people who are able to provide the goods with the right kind of quality, at the right speed, with the right cost, I mean, it's a fair competition, a fair market, and people with those attributes are going to come out ahead.
It's nice to hear you talk about the creation of jobs and not the loss of them, because I think a lot of times when we have conversations like this, the immediate attention is put to how many jobs are going to be lost to, automation and robots and artificial intelligence. So that's a positive.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not necessarily a bad thing when you look at it from that lens, because, mind you, the skills are going to change. It's going to be a slightly different world where people will be interacting with computers and so on at a higher degree or a higher level of education. But these are good jobs from the perspective that the pay is going to be good, the working conditions are going to be good. So it's not all bad when we look at it from that lens.
So we appreciate you being with us this morning. This is a good conversation. We're going to link out to some of your work at atkearney.com, and we appreciate you being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Asaz Farooqi with us this morning. He's a senior manager of operations and performance transformation at AT Kearney. Again, atkearney.com. We'll link out to it in the podcast later this morning at WGNradio.com.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward opening gains on Wall Street after a rough day yesterday. Up nearly 0.5% on the Dow. Same story with the S&P and the NASDAQ. Now, agriculture and commodities. Here's Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. A good day in the wheat market yesterday as wheat futures jumped more than 3%. Thanks to short covering by funds coupled with expectations of maybe a pickup in export business. Corn futures followed wheat higher. Soybeans, however, went down because of increased soybean inventories. So at the end of the day, we saw the December wheat contract up 16¾ cents a bushel. The December corn was unchanged and March only down 0.5 cent. And November soybeans down 5¼ cents a bushel, closing at 871¾. Now, turning to the livestock trade yesterday, a fairly quiet day in the market, except for the lean hog contract. February lean hogs gained $2.37 a hundredweight. The December live cattle contract was up 37 cents a hundredweight. And the November feeder cattle contract ended down 70 cents a hundredweight. No harvest progress report today because yesterday was a federal holiday. USDA offices were closed. You have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. Now let's look at the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk for the outlook for this Tuesday, November the 13th. We'll get a look at the Red Book today. The NFIB, Small Business Optimism Index, also due. We'll see a couple of Fed speakers out there as well, and also the Treasury budget due later in the day. On the earnings calendar today, Aramark, Home Depot, and Tyson Food earnings. Home Depot already out of the gate. Shares in Home Depot are higher after a good earnings report and positive guidance going forward. Just some of the things that could move the markets as we move forward on this Tuesday, November the 13th.